This is Audible.
Audible Inc. presents The Baby Boom. How it got that way, and it wasn't my fault, and I'll never do it again. Written by P.J. O'Rourke. Narrated by Dick Hill.
The Baby Boom is dedicated to the memory of Clifford Bronson O'Rourke and Delphine Loy O'Rourke, progenitors thereof. Thou shalt not answer questionnaires or quizzes upon world affairs, nor with compliance take any test. Thou shalt not sit with statisticians, nor commit a social science. W. H. Auden, from Under Which Lyre. In lapidary inscriptions, a man is not upon oath. Dr. Samuel Johnson. Preface to a book attempting to capture the spirit of a generation of God's favorite spoiled brats. Herein is a ballad of the baby boom, not a dissertation on it. A rhapsody, not a report. A freehand sketch, not a faithful rendering. That is to say, I am... It is a writer's vocation and the métier of his age cohort, full of crap. Characters, the narrator included, have been drawn from nature and not from individuals. Essence has been added and occidence has been omitted. Merry hell has been played with time, place, personages, and recalled dialogue. Twice-told tales have been trotted out onto the court for three-peats. And come now, fellow baby boomers, confess your own guilt to the same. Only the most outrageous and unbelievable things in this book are recounted exactly as they happened. There was a generation that had a lot of hair right in the middle of their forehead. When they were good, they were very good indeed. But when they were bad, they were horrid. With apologies to Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. Prologue. We are the world. We are the generation that changed everything. Of all the eras and epochs of Americans, ours is the one that made the biggest impression on ourselves. But that's an important accomplishment because we're the generation that created the self, made the firmament of the self, divided the light of the self from the darkness of the self, and said, "Let there be self." If you were born between 1946 and 1964, you may have noticed this yourself. That's not to say we're a selfish generation. Selfish means too concerned with the self, and we're not. Self isn't something we're just, you know, concerned with. We are self. Before us, self was without form and void, like our parents in their dumpy clothes and vague ideas. Then we came along. Now the personal is the political. The personal is the socio-economic. The personal is the religious and the secular, science and the arts. The personal is everything that creepeth upon the earth after his, and let us hasten to add, her, kind. If the baby boom has done one thing, it's to beget a personal universe. And our apologies to anyone who personally happens to be a jerk. Self is like fish, proverbially speaking. Give a man a fish, and you've fed him for a day. Teach a man to fish, and if he turns into a dry fly, catch-and-release angling fanatic up to his liver in icy water wearing ridiculous waders and an absurd hat, pestering trout with 3-pound test line on a $1,000 graphite rod and going on endlessly about royal coachman lures that he tied himself using muskrat fur and partridge feathers, well, at least his life partner is glad to have him out of the house. We made the universe personal, and we made the universe new. New in the sense of juvenescent. We have an abiding admiration for our own larval state. We saw that the grown-ups were like primitive insects. They never underwent metamorphosis. They didn't emerge from their home and office cocoons with brilliant fluttering wings. They just continued to molt, getting more gross, lumpy, and bald, and, as it were, bugging us. Better that we should stay nymphs and naiads. Plus, we were having more fun than the adults of the species. "Don't ever change," we wrote in each other's high school yearbooks. "Stay just the way you are." What strange valedictions to give ourselves on the threshold of life. Imagine if we had obeyed them, and now everyone possessed the resolute solipsism of adolescence with its wild enthusiasms, dark lethargies, strong lusts, keen aversions, inner turmoils, and uncontained impulses. Life would be exactly like it is today. You're welcome. So here we are, in the baby boom cosmos, formed in our image, personally tailored to our individual needs and predetermined to be eternally fresh and novel. And we saw that it was good. Or pretty good. We should have had a cooler name, the way the Lost Generation did. Except, good luck to anybody who tries to tell us to get lost. Anyway, it's too late now. We're stuck with being forever described as exploding infants. And maybe it's time, now that we've splattered ourselves all over the place, for the baby boom to look back and think, what made us who we are? And what caused us to act the way we do? And WTF? Because the truth is, if we hadn't decided to be young forever, we'd be old. The youngest baby boomers, born in the last year when anybody thought it was hip to like Lyndon Johnson, are turning 50. Those of us who were born when post-war birth rates were highest, even before Ike was liked, won't, statistics tell us, have to wait as long for death as we had to wait to get laid. We'd be sad about this if we weren't too busy remarrying younger wives, reviving careers that hit glass ceilings when children arrived, and renewing prescriptions for drugs that keep us from being sad. And we'll never retire. We can't. The mortgage is underwater. We're in debt up to the Rogaine for the kids' college education, and it serves us right. We're the generation who insisted that a passion for living should replace working for one. Nonetheless, it's an appropriate moment for us to weigh what we've wrought and tally what we've added to and subtracted from existence. We've reached the age of accountability. The world is our fault. We are the generation that has an excuse for everything, one of our greatest contributions to modern life. But the world is still our fault. This is every generation's fate. It's a matter of power and privilege demography. Whenever anything happens anywhere, somebody over 50 signs the bill for it. And the baby boom, seated as we are at the head of life's table, is hearing Generation X, Generation Y, and the millennials all saying, "Check, please." How can he get wisdom whose talk is of bullocks? Ecclesiasticus 38:25, The Apocrypha. 1. A regular old baby boomer speaks. To address America's baby boom is to face big, broad problems. We number more than 75 million, and we're not only diverse, but take a thorny pride in our every deviation from the norm, even though we're in therapy for it. We are all alike about us each being unusual. Fortunately, we are all alike about big, broad problems, too. We won't face them. There's a website for that, a support group to join, a class to take, alternative medicine, regular exercise, a book that explains it all, a celebrity on TV who's been through the same thing, or we can eliminate gluten from our diet. History is full of generations that had too many problems. We are the first generation to have too many answers. Not a problem. Consider the people who have faced up squarely to the deepest and most perplexing conundrums of existence. Leo Tolstoy, for example. He tackled every one of them. Why are we here? What kind of life should we lead? The nature of evil, the character of love, the essence of identity, salvation, suffering, death. What did it get him? Dead, for one thing, and off his rocker for the last 30 years of his life. Plus, he was saddled with a 1,000-page novel about war, peace, and everything else you can think of, which he couldn't even look up on Wikipedia to get the skinny on because he hadn't written it yet. What a life. If Leo Tolstoy had been one of us, he could have entered a triathlon, a baby boom innovation of the middle 1970s. By then, we knew we couldn't run away from our problems. But if we added cycling and swimming... So to the problems of talking about the baby boom, let us turn our big, broad, yet soon to be firmed up due to the triathlon for seniors that we're planning to enter, generational backsides. Nonetheless, a difficulty remains. Most groups of people who get tagged by history as a generation can be described in an easy, offhand way. Folks sort of the same age experiencing sort of the same things in sort of the same place. Like the cast of Cheers, or Seinfeld, or Friends. I'm almost sure, as a result of taking modern literature in college, that Ernest Hemingway, F. Scott, and Zelda Fitzgerald, James Joyce, Gertrude Stein, Ford Madox, Ford Henry Miller, and Ezra Pound were roommates in a big apartment on the Left Bank in Paris in the 1920s. If not, I give the sitcom idea free to the reader. But the baby boom has an exact definition, a precise demography. We are the children who were born during a period after World War II, when the long-term trend in fertility among American women was exceeded. Our mothers began this excess abruptly in 1946. They peaked in their use of the stuff that makes babies in 1947, and thereafter, they gradually tapered off until in 1964 they were taking the pill, or rolling over and pretending to be asleep, or telling their husbands, "Go phone the Pope about where to buy rubbers." As a generation, we are spread across the huge space of America and span so much time that the oldest baby boomers are sometimes the parents, usually via an oopsie, of the youngest baby boomers. It's painful to think how many of those babies were put up for adoption because it was too soon for the baby boom to have soothed the fierce mores of society. Shame was still felt about illegitimate children as if the cooings, gurgles, and spit-ups of some infants conformed to established rules and regulations, while the cooings, gurgles, and spit-ups of other infants weren't legal. On the other hand, in fairness, society may have had an inkling of just how hard it would be to extract child support payments from baby boom fathers. Anyway, distinctions among varieties of baby boomers need to be made. Geographical distinctions are peripatetically moot for us. I have a friend who says he got so stoned in the 1960s that the next thing he remembers is standing in line for a Procol Harum concert at New York's Fillmore East with a ticket in his hand for a Procol Harum concert at San Francisco's Fillmore West. Distinctions according to race, class, gender, or sexual orientation would be offensive to baby boom sensitivities. Furthermore, they'd be beside the point because the author, much as he endeavors to be as different from everyone else as a member of the baby boom should be, finds himself to be hopelessly ordinary in matters of race, class, gender identification, and which section of Playboy he turned to first when he was 16. But time is a distinction we all have to endure. And there are temporal variations in the baby boom. We have our seniors, our juniors, our sophomores, and our freshmen. The seniors were born in the late 1940s. The author is of that ilk. This book is necessarily written from the ilk's point of view. The first pronouncement of the baby boom is, "I have to be me." It's as if we think the pronouncements of all those who came before us were something like, "I have to be Gerald and Betty Ford." Then Dad's hair began to thin, and he whacked somebody with a golf ball, and Mom got a little tipsy. The baby boom speaks the truth. The seniors were on the bow wave of the baby boom's voyage of exploration, but they were also closely tethered in the wake of preceding generations. In effect, the seniors were keel-hauled by the baby boom experience and left a bit soggy and shaken. If we wound up as financial advisors trying to wear tongue studs, or Trotskyites trying to organize Tea Party protests, or both, we are to be forgiven. Hillary Clinton and Cheech Marin are seniors. The juniors were born in the early 1950s. They were often younger siblings of the seniors and came of age when parents were throwing in the towel during the "What's the Matter with Kids These Days?" feature match. The juniors pursued the notions, whims, and fancies of the baby boom with a greater intensity. For them, drugs were no longer experimental. Drugs were proven. John Belushi was technically a senior born in 1949, but knowing John, he was probably held back a couple of grades and can be counted as a junior. From the juniors, we get the teeny boppers, the groupies, and the more ragamuffin barefoot urchins of Haight Ashbury. They hunted up some shoes when they eventually made their way to Silicon Valley. Bill Gates and Steve Jobs were both born in 1955, but they never did find their neckties. The sophomores were born in the late 1950s. By the time they reached adolescence, the baby boom ethos had permeated society. Sophomores gladly accepted sex, drugs, rock and roll, and the deep philosophical underpinning thereof. But they'd seen enough of the baby boom in action to realize that what works in general terms doesn't always work when the bong sets fire to the beanbag chair. Circumstances had changed. In college, many of the sophomores attended classes. Some even snuck off and got MBAs. I have a friend who went to Stanford in 1973. The Stanford campus is home to the redoubtable conservative Hoover Institution think tank. When my friend arrived at the school, the Hoover Institution's office windows were boarded up as high as a rock could be thrown. We're not the most athletic generation, so the windows didn't have to be boarded up too far. That year, the boards were taken down. The sophomores were the authors of the official Preppy Handbook. The freshmen were born in the early 1960s. All that the baby boom had wrought was, for them, a given. What we accomplished with blood, sweat, and tears, or really with buds, sweat, other lubricants, and tear gas, or, in actual fact, with listening to blood, sweat, and tears, especially spinning wheel over and over again on the record player while we stared at the amazing kaleidoscopic patterns in the linoleum, freshmen took for granted. They felt no visceral effects from the events that formed the baby boom. To freshmen, the Vietnam War was just something that was inexplicably on TV all the time, like Ed McMahon. Feminism had gone from a pressing social issue to a B. Arthur comedy show that their parents liked. And by the time the freshmen were in college, feminism was an essay topic for the Reading Shakespeare in Cultural Context course. Hint. Lady Macbeth hit that glass ceiling hard. Freshmen have no personal memory of the Kennedy and King assassinations, which showed the tragedy inherent in greatness and taught the baby boom to stop just short of it. the way Bill Clinton did. They may have suffered a momentary golden oldies pang when John Lennon was shot, thinking maybe now the original Wings will never be reunited. The freshmen didn't witness the monumental civil rights movement. They were taught that it was monumental in school. Being taught that a thing is monumental in school turns it into an intellectually unvisited memorial, a Grant's tomb of the mind. To the freshmen, racism, sexism, and homophobia are as much slurs as facts. They don't even stop to puzzle over the evil the way I stopped at an Alabama gas station on a 1959 car trip to Florida to puzzle over the drinking fountain labeled colored. Not that I was puzzling over evil at the moment, because I had no idea what colored could have to do with a drinking fountain. Colored water? Bad idea. Why would anybody want it? And that's pretty much as far as freshmen get with moral reasoning about America. Good for them. They live in a better country. They have the luxury of fretting over things like the deficit, the one percenters, the congressional deadlock, the fairness of the nation's health insurance system, and whether, if they spend a lot of time at the gym and get a tattoo, they stand any chance of hooking up with 26-year-olds. They're still baby boomers. The freshmen may be different in many ways from the baby boom's upperclassmen, but there's no mistaking them for members of any of the younger and duller, if hotter, generations. The tip-off is the blather, the jabber, the prattle, the natter, the gab, gas, yak, yap, baloney, blarney, bunkum, the jaw-slinging, tongue-wagging, gum-beating chin music that is the baby boom's gift to the world. Stephen Colbert is a freshman. So is Ann Coulter. So are John Stewart, Sarah Palin, Conan O'Brien, and Larry the Cable Guy. Among prominent freshman baby boomers is President Barack Obama. There was a controversy when he was running for president that showed how much of a freshman baby boomer President Obama is, and also illustrated what an extraordinary change the baby boom has made in the nature of American flapdoodle. President and Mrs. Obama were members of Trinity United Church of Christ in Chicago. Trinity's pastor, until early 2008, was the Reverend Jeremiah Wright. Reverend Wright had married Mr. and Mrs. Obama and baptized their children. Reverend Wright is a man of strong views, forcefully delivered, and, shall we say, not always tactfully put. In a sermon after 9/11, Reverend Wright said, "We bombed Hiroshima, we bombed Nagasaki, and we nuked far more than the thousands in New York and the Pentagon, and we never batted an eye. And now we are indignant because the stuff we have done overseas is now brought back into our own front yard." In another sermon he said, "The government lied about inventing the HIV virus as a means of genocide against people of color." And most famously he said, "God damn America." Now, a senior baby boomer, especially in the senior baby boom's 1960s heyday, would have been standing on a pew, clenched fist raised in the air, shouting in response with fervid suggestions for righteous action, probably involving property damage at the nearby University of Chicago. A sophomore baby boomer, assuming the sophomore was awake early enough for a church service and could find the church, would have been nodding in stoned agreement and hoping that Trinity United's activist social ministry included free lunch. A junior baby boomer would have been muttering to himself, "That might be pitching things a bit high and inside." But a freshman baby boomer? The controversy played out after various news organizations and political opponents took professional umbrage at Reverend Wright's sermons with anticlimactic results. Although Senator Obama sat in the congregation, there was no indication that he paid any attention whatsoever to Reverend Wright. The freshman baby boomer was born into a sea of hui and swims about comfortably therein, unaware that other environments of discourse exist. For all we know, while the Reverend Jeremiah Wright fulminated and swore, the future president was fiddling with his BlackBerry, blabbing to Rahm Emanuel. It is the baby boom way. Once people spoke their minds, and what awful things we heard, compared to Reverend Wright, born 1941, above. Baby boom speech is not mindless, but there's a cardiac bypass. We speak from the heart, and that's not the half of it. We speak from the gut, from the spleen, from the liver's bile ducts, out our butts, through our hats. Even our T-shirts cannot shut up with the things we have to say. Never mind social media and talk radio, talk show call-in callers. We talk until the cows come home. And who keeps cows anymore? We talk of cabbages and kings, as well we might, because who among us can tell the king of Saudi Arabia from a cabbage? Bernice aside. We found drugs, speed, cocaine, Starbucks, that were talk itself in pill, powder, and custom frappuccino form. And yet, one thing that cannot be said about the baby boom is it's all talk. You can't say that about a generation whose powers of language are so fundamentally transformative that one of its members ran for president using the name Barack when everybody knows he's called Barry. America in the two decades after World War II was full to the point of sloshing over with motive, means, and opportunity. There was a feeling that children born into this age of high purpose, wide prosperity, and handsome prospects could be or do anything. It wasn't a fact. But facts are faint things next to feelings. Facts are acknowledged. Feelings are felt. What makes the baby boom different from other generations is the way everybody was feeling we could be or do anything. What unifies the baby boom is the way we talked everybody into letting us get away with it. We know nothing of tomorrow. Our business is to be good and happy today. Reverend Sidney Smith. 2. A good and happy place. Personally speaking, and personally is the only way our generation does speak, and personally is the only way a book about the baby boom could be written, I think the world we've changed should be measured against the world as it was when the baby boom was a baby. There was a life we got before we got life by the throat. And personally speaking, in an average kind of family, in an average sort of neighborhood, in an average part of America, this was a pleasant life, on average. Among the earliest memories I can summon is one of pure awe, the kind produced by our first glimpse of the Rockies, or of enormous surf, or, to use a more apt comparison, of anything on the screen when we got our first television. And I do mean anything. Farm Report, Mass for Shut-ins, the Today Show with Dave Garraway, co-anchored by a chimpanzee named J. Fred Muggs. Not as attractive as Katie Couric, but as incisive. However, we didn't get a television until the average 50% by 1953, American household did. So I'm standing at a living room window, chin on the sill, watching the big kids walk to school. All children, at all times, have wanted to be adults, except the baby boom. We wanted to be older, greater children. There were plenty of them going by my house. Every neighborhood had lots of kids in those days, though the baby boom was hardly underway. Come to think of it, every neighborhood had lots of parents. There was a daily parade of generations to be viewed. I was looking at the march of the silent, generation. Not that they were silent, coming down the sidewalks. They were, I noted with envy, making the glorious racket of free individuals out and about on their own. They seemed, as well as I was able to form such a thought, to be the very personification of riotous autonomy. They did invent rock and roll, after all. Some of them built loud hot rods. Some indulged in clamorous behavior that had the nation fretting about juvenile delinquency. The baby boom would have an ultimately disappointing relationship with the silent generation. Sometimes the relationship started with older siblings, more often with the babysitter. My babysitter would play rock and roll on our phonograph, and a boy with a ducktail haircut would visit her when the grown-ups were safely gone. Bill Haley and his comets didn't sound like much to a child's ears, thumpy and repetitive, but the music had a kind of disturbed urgency. Children like disturbance. I urgently hoped the babysitter and the boy with a ducktail haircut would do something disturbing, like, let me look at the switchblade knife that boys with ducktail haircuts were said to carry, or play doctor with each other. Maybe that happened on the couch after I'd been put to bed, but the generation that was born too late for service in World War II was also born too early for much beyond a dry hump. As far as I could tell, the most transgressive thing they did was make popcorn without permission. The silent generation seemed to hold an unfulfilled promise of interesting social agitation. The term silent generation was coined in a 1951 cover article from Time magazine, then, as now, the digest of what educated cement heads think. Time wrote, "Youth today is waiting for the hand of fate to fall on its shoulders." The Korean War wasn't fate enough. Meanwhile, working fairly hard and saying almost nothing. Mort Saul, Dick Gregory, George Carlin, Richard Pryor, and everyone in Monty Python were members of the silent generation. Although it turns out they were just kidding. The hand of fate appeared to be always almost ready to fall upon the shoulders of the silent generation and turn them into James Dean or Maynard G. Krebs, but they couldn't quite get the goatee to grow or find a Porsche to crash. Speaking of fate and its hands, there's never been a silent generation president, unless we count Jimmy Carter, who was technically a member of the greatest generation, but didn't graduate from the Naval Academy until 1946. This generational chief executive lacuna is probably the result of what students of the electoral process call the road trip factor. Going on a road trip with a baby boomer president would be bad enough. Barack Obama having smug disagreements with the GPS telling it, "This is a debate I want to have." Bill Clinton driving off the road every time a pedestrian with breasts appeared. George H.W. Bush might have been fun once before he gave up beer. But think about going on a road trip with Jimmy Carter. Somehow, the silent generation was mostly just noise. They are the generation who ultimately surrendered to adulthood. We are the generation who kept fighting the battles of adolescence down to the present day. Between the baby boom and the silent generation, there is a marked difference in outlook, opinion, and polyester Sansevelt pants. My other glowing toddler memory is Dad coming home from work. The greatest generation arrives. The sight of my father driving up the driveway produces an exultant thrill, and not just because he often brought a toy. We in the baby boom had an unadulterated love for our parents that few children, past or future, have matched. Maybe we surpassed what other children felt for their parents because, in the past, children grew up in colder and more crowded homes with mushier meals and the razor straps still hanging by the bathroom sink. And in the future, children had us for moms and dads. Our parents didn't get divorced. They didn't hit us much. If they were neurotic, they had the good manners to have a drink instead of a long talk with us about it. They were stricter, or are remembered as being so, than we would be with our kids. But they were less pestering and intrusive. A greatest generation parent was as likely to turn up at school blaming a teacher for his kid's poor arithmetic grade as Xi Jinping is likely to turn up at Amnesty International blaming Bono for his country's poor human rights record. Our parents may have been distant by modern standards, but a certain distance is helpful in adulation. I remember riding in a car with my mother, lolling around on the front seat, as children were allowed to do. I looked at her face, sunlit in profile, and was so stricken by her beauty and so overwhelmed by my love for her that I despaired of any adequate positive expression of my feelings and reached over and pulled the hood release on the Buick. And only a few years later, we would hold this generation in categorical contempt. During the 1960s, we would talk about our parents as a group in a way that today we would be embarrassed to talk about militant Islamic fundamentalists as a group. Our depth and breadth of prejudice would shock every one of our 21st century sensibilities, if we ever thought about it, which we don't, because later still, we got all soppy and sentimental about the greatest generation, just in time to put them in nursing homes, or the grave. In my fledgling recollections, the Jazz Age generation is also somewhere around the house. Every neighborhood had lots of grandparents, too, although their exact function wasn't clear. They weren't leading their own lives the way grandparents do today, nor were they raising the kids their kids had abandoned to their care. They certainly weren't having second careers. A job did not define a person in the Jazz Age. Jay Gatsby didn't even have a job. One career, at the very most, used to be considered enough. Grandma's 1920s had had flaming youth, rude manners, shocking fashions, permissive sex, illegal drugs in the bathtub gin, atrocious music, and sillier dancing than a Grateful Dead concerts. Everything the baby boom set out to do in the 1960s had been done already, 40 years before. But suddenly, and completely, it had disappeared. Our beliefs and behaviors would live on. After another 40 years, and counting, we can tune in NPR. Turn on MSNBC, or drop out on the couch with the Sunday New York Times and be re-immersed in our groovy notions of yore. We can visit Burning Man, an Occupy Whatnot demonstration, or Portland, Oregon, and see our bygone selves replicated with a few additional piercings and neck tattoos. If we weren't so used to this, it would be astonishing, as though we had arrived on campus in 1967 to find all the co-eds in cloche hats with stockings rolled down to their knees and "Oh, you kid" written in grease pencil on their yellow rain slickers, singing, "Yes, we have no bananas," and voicing strong opinions on the pressing question of whether girls should bob their hair. Were the 20s a failed experiment at having a 60s? Like a first attempt at a space launch blowing up on the pad? Or do anomalies in youthful Weltanschauung pop up from time to time in a meaningless fashion? There have been such blips in the past. The Romantic movement, the French Revolution. But they didn't have a generation like the baby boom to make it stick. Still, it is a mystery how the flappers and whoopee makers and bright young things wound up as our grandparents, wearing aprons over ugly, flowered house dresses, or baggy pants mismatched to old suit coats, puttering in the garden, muttering to themselves in the kitchen, and looking out over the tops of their bifocals puzzled at our 1950s childhood world, which was, one would think, so much less puzzling than the hip flask and 23 skidoo world that had been theirs. Actually, my own grandmother would have been the wrong person to ask about these things. Presbyterian daughter of a downstate county sheriff and widow of a postmaster appointed by Calvin Coolidge, she was a kind of Republican who was still mad at Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt, for splitting the Republican Party in 1912 and allowing a Woodrow Wilson to be elected. There are hazards in generational generalizations. But I had another elderly relative. As far as I knew, he was a retired supermarket meat cutter whose main interest was pitching horseshoes. One time, in my 20s, I deigned to sit and talk with him. It was Christmas or something. He had played trumpet in the band at a speakeasy with a whorehouse upstairs. Numerous mysteries would unfold and were unfolding in the quotidian existence of the 1950s. The idea that we had an uncomplicated and sterile past is an invention to flatter ourselves about our complex and richly organic present. There was the mystery of what was in the attic, something large and horrible, I was sure. The door to the attic stairs opened into my room. I couldn't go to sleep until I had checked two or three times to make sure that the hook and eye latch was fastened. I don't recall considering what kind of large and horrible thing would be stopped by a small hook and eye in a cheap hollow door. Anyway, there was something worse in the basement. To be sent down there after dark to get a clean pair of socks for school the next day was to experience fear beyond telling. And the night wind gave dreadful clawing shapes to the branches on the tree in the front yard. Never mind that the house had been built the year before. The tree still had the fabric from the plant nursery wrapped around its trunk and was under 4 feet tall. The basement was brightly lit, as yet uncluttered, and so clean and dry that I could smell the concrete curing in the foundation. And the cobweb-free attic barely had room for the two suitcases and one broken cane chair it contained. We are an imaginative generation. Our parents weren't, or rather they deliberately chose not to be. Our parents put a lot of thought and planning into the avoidance of imagination. This is the solution to the mystery of the houses we grew up in, which were too ugly to have been designed and decorated simply by accident. Every imaginable disaster seemed to have occurred in our parents' lifetime. Financial panic, sudden spread of grinding poverty, absurd popular ideologies, fanatical governments, systematic murder of millions of innocents, military conflict everywhere in the world, and the invention of a bomb that would obliterate a whole city. For any further imagination, our parents had no use. The exception was their cars. With automobiles, the greatest generation let imagination take flight, almost literally, given the aviational sheet metal on some of their vehicles. The cars of the 1950s and 60s are a byword, almost a synonym for crass materialistic excess. Intellectuals, to this day, lodge particular complaint against the tail fins. Perhaps they take the ornamental use of fins personally, many intellectuals being fishy types. But upswept rear fenders and the equally inveighed against lavish application of chrome are the least of what makes the era's American cars astounding. Some are strange, such as the 1950 Bathtub Hudson and the Which Way Did It Go 1950 Studebaker. Some are stranger, like the 1960 Plymouth Valiant, which looks as if its styling was done by four men who lacked a common language, working together in a dark room. Some are examples of industrial design perfected, with form following function and function chasing a beauty all its own. The 1953 through 1955 Studebakers and the Willys Jeep station wagon that stayed in production almost without visible changes from 1946 to 1965. Some are works of art. You can tell by the way baby boomers, paying through the nose, fill our garages with these instead of with Rothko's. There's the 1948 Chrysler Town and Country Convertible, the 1955 Ford Thunderbird, the 1955 Chevrolet Nomad, the 1965 Ford Mustang, and all Corvettes until 1973 when they start to get too trial separation and comb-over looking. And some of the greatest generation's cars are an amazement. For example, the 1959 Chevrolet Biscayne. Here was Chevy's least expensive model, a get-to-worker, mommy shopper, kitty-hauler budget conveyance, and Hydra headlamps, dagger-slit hood scoops, gridiron grill big enough for a cannibal roast with 7 chrome nipples down the 50-yard line, taillights like the giant fangs of a basilisk, and 2 great hatchet-edged swoops of steel across the trunk lid. It makes the Batmobile look like a Scion XB. I have digressed here. I know. Like any good baby boom boy, my age would. Give us a look at 4 square feet of the bodywork on any car built between World War II and the Arab oil embargo, and we'll tell you the make, model, and year with more accuracy than we get from our PSA tests. But it is worth noting that the greatest generation took all of its creativity, artistic feeling, and aesthetic sensibilities and put them on wheels. It's as if they felt, okay, we do have an imagination, but let's make sure we can get it out of here. Their cars aside, the post-war life the greatest generation wanted for themselves and for us was a unique combination of the intensely dynamic and the adamantly prosaic. And this is the life they got. It was fantasy-free, fantasy fulfillment, and science fiction, hold the fiction. Hence my house, built in 1951. It was not a pseudo-colonial. Pseudo derives from the Greek word meaning to deceive or counterfeit. No deception was made or intended. Somewhere in the aesthetic genome was a Massachusetts Bay Colony cape that had shed its dormers and shingles and grown clapboard and a second story after being mated to a center hall Federalist dwelling where the center hall had atrophied to a coat closet inside the front door. Only one hearth remained, and that was vestigial, except on special occasions when the firewood Dad brought home filled the house with smoke. Le Corbusier, foremost of the mid-century architectural theorists who wrecked the world's downtowns with glass tombstones and confined the poor in vertical concrete slums, had blandly called a house a machine for living. Our parents were the avant-garde of Le Corbusier in blandness. My house was a box for wife and family. And a comfortable, cheerful, well-padded, and carefully placed box it was. The flaps were left open. As our generation is fond of saying, we never locked the doors in the place where we grew up. That's not accurate. When night came and kids were in bed, moms and dads living in tediously safe locales went around turning deadbolts and fastening door chains. We think of them as unworried, smoking while pregnant, having one for the road before driving the family home, turning us loose in the backyard with lawn darts. But they did worry, in their generation's careful, limited way. They had certain firm ideas of what to worry about. They had never had the opportunity to develop contemporary, diverse, inclusive, free-range worry. They were more specifically anxious than we are, without the general anxiety. In this, their smoking and drinking certainly helped. What our parents were most anxious for was us. First, for us to be born, and then for us to be happy and good. This is why they put so much effort into making sure the non-pseudo-colonial house was in a good and happy place, the place where we grew up. Now that we want our kids to be brilliant and successful, we're free to move back to the city or out to Sedona or into mansion ghettos full of people with whom we are purposely strangers. Our parents hadn't learned to outsource their children's good and happy place. They were ignorant of au pair supervision, the Suzuki method of early childhood stringed instrument instruction, math camp, and infant Pilates classes. They didn't know how to get us into private schools that accept only the top 0% of applicants, or sports programs reserved for those who will one day podium at the Olympics. Our parents needed a public place for us. So we grew up in the suburbs, though with an experience somewhat different from what grew up in the suburbs would come to mean. I thought carpool was another swell new idea from GM. Dad had the car at work. Mom's car was a used one, if it existed. If it didn't, Mom took the bus. Grandma never learned to drive. She called a taxi. We rode our bikes. None of us was headed far. Suburbia hadn't yet expanded into a vast place where, our social critics tell us, there's nowhere to go and it's a long way to get there. A great deal of thinking, mostly of the agonized kind, has been done about the effects of suburbanization on America. As if there were some hidden cabalistic meaning in more nice homes and convenient places to work and shop. The meaning of the baby boom suburbs was that, because of depression and war, nobody had built any houses for a while, and a lot of babies were being born. Urban was still the meaningful part of the word, suburban. People lived a driveway apart, back fence to back fence, with no lap pool enclosures, or lap pools to be enclosed, and no landscaping services trimming dense shrubbery screens. Streets retained their grid pattern. Each street was still called such-and-such street, rather than such-and-drive or and-such-way. Dead ends had not yet gained the cachet of cul-de-sacs. Suburban neighborhoods began a block or two from the city's shabby early 20th century apartment buildings and paint-peeled Victorian piles now split into duplexes or rented by the room. Even where land was at no premium, out on the verge of town, a quarter-acre lot was a bit magnificent. And there were neighbors in the country, too. Farms were smaller. Other farmhouses were within shouting distance. Quite a few of our parents, and most of our grandparents, had grown up on such farms, either here or in some other country. This may be why the children of my neighborhood continued shouting. We seldom knocked on doors, and never, except on Halloween, rang doorbells. When we wanted to contact a friend, the accepted form was to stand outside his house and shout his name at the top of our lungs, "Oh, Billy!" with the last syllable greatly prolonged and shrilly emphasized. Children were forbidden independent use of the telephone. Any other form of personal communication technology, had it existed, would have been considered ridiculous. "Oh, Billy!" could be heard a block and a half away. If a kid lived more than a block and a half away, we didn't know him. Adults themselves didn't use the telephone any more than necessary. Party lines were still common. 2 rings for the Andersons, 1 ring for us. To say something on a party line was to tell the world. That it would be wonderful to tell the world one's every thought and feeling hadn't occurred to people yet. Our house had a single phone, in the dining room, on a shelf, in a nook specifically designed to accommodate it. A call after 9 p.m. meant, at best, that someone in the family had died. Either that, or the call had been pre-arranged by mail with my mother's sister in Chicago to take advantage of lower nighttime long-distance rates. On long-distance calls, Grandma shouted. It was, after all, a long distance. People used to speak face-to-face. They did so in their own backyards over garden gates, as seen in ancient daily newspaper comic strips. Sometimes, in the background, there'd be a clothesline or a manually operated push lawnmower. People talked a lot as an excuse to quit wrestling with wet bedsheets or stop shoving machinery through crabgrass. Of course, people still talk a lot, although what they're excusing themselves from now, I don't know. Anyway, when people spoke face-to-face 60 years ago, they weren't also fiddling with their smartphones, facing other people's faces on Facebook when they were supposed to be facing you, and you weren't checking your email and replying to your text messages when you were facing them. People had to speak directly to each other, paying attention to what they were saying and to what was being said. How they withstood the tedium, I can't imagine. In topics of conversation, our parents ranged from bed sheets to lawnmowers. Would an automatic dryer send the electric bill through the roof? Those new rotary-style power jobs could take your whole foot off. I would listen in, for a moment at the most. Sometimes there was good gossip between the moms. But the malice of children, like the malice of politicians, is an entirely public thing. We were not mature enough to enjoy a refined taste for private character assassination, nor, social media evidence indicates, are we yet. Sometimes there was good sports talk between the dads, but a dad who knew enough about sports to be worth listening to would be playing in the major leagues. It was all we could do to get ours to play catch. People used to write to each other. Any holiday departure, even to visit relatives in Ashtabula, occasioned picture postcards to all. The messages were sometimes jocular, but never a joke. Not even, "Weather is here, wish you were beautiful." And the pictures on the postcards were not ironic. Irony, as a mode of communication, was well understood by our parents. They called saying the opposite of what is meant lying, or being sarcastic. They used irony often, but as a way to tell the world to piss off, not as a way to regard life, and certainly not as a way to say hi to friends and relations. An extended separation, particularly from family, demanded frequent and voluminous correspondence. These missives were chatty, discursive, and brimming with minutiae. My mother and her sister wrote to each other once or twice a week. I have a packet of their letters. Sewed the girls the cutest pair of matching aprons with pockets in the shape of Valentine hearts. Tried Great Aunt Stella's recipe for oatmeal cookies. Used oleo instead of lard. These letters, more than half a century old, are remarkably like today's mom blogs. It's a subtle question what kind of progress has been made with human intercourse. In the bloggers' favor, they do talk about intercourse, which is interesting. In my mother's and aunt's favor, they didn't, which is a relief. To the credit of the bloggers, they make a desperate effort to entertain, however bitter and disappointed they may be. To the credit of Mom and Aunt Margie, they made a desperate effort to express no bitterness and disappointment, however entertaining that would have been. Our parents lived in a world poised between intimacy and privacy, not one that paradoxically lacks both. My mother and my aunt were more boring than bloggers, but bloggers are boring everyone. My mother and my aunt bored only each other. Even so, the Greatest Generation had tools aboard him that are little known. These